Hi, welcome to another episode of Django Chat, a fortnightly podcast on the Django Web Framework. I'm Will Vincent, joined by Carlton Gibson. Hi, Carlton.
Hello, Will.
And this week we have Ken Whitesell to join us to talk about all things Django, the forum, and his long history with the framework. Welcome, Ken.
Good morning. Welcome. Thank you.
So, as ever, we try to think of how to introduce our guests onto the show, and it can't really narrowly put you in a bucket all the things you've done to contribute to Django. So maybe we could start with, how did you get into programming? And then we'll work our way into how you became so involved in the Django world.
Oh, my goodness. We're trying to keep this at under an hour, right? Let's try to give the condensed version here. Actually got started with programming with a programmable calculator, an old TISR 52 from back in the late 70s. The time that had the little magnetic card strips that you would feed through the calculator that would store the programs and the thermal printers that you could attach to it. Had a friend of mine in high school who had one of those, and we just spent hours mucking around with that, writing little programs. Really was my introduction. It's what gave me the bug. And then from there, everything just kind of mushroomed. My senior year of high school, we had moved. And I moved to a high school that actually had access to a mini computer at the time, an old HP 2000, running the old timeshare BASIC. And that was my first actual education in it. And I caught the bug immediately. I knew right then and there within like my first week of that class that I knew what I was going to do for the rest of my life.
Fantastic. Wow. So that trumps the usual questions. We're always like, so did you learn at university? Did you, you know, and you're like, no, I learned at high school.
Or at least got exposed to it.
Well, that's great that you both had access to a real computer. And then with the calculator and games, you could sort of have some sort of hands-on experience with it. Because I think games for a lot of people was one of the first entryways. For me, because I'm a little bit younger, it was sort of the web. The web came around when I was in high school. Middle school, high school. So that was the first like tangible using technology. Oh, what is this thing? Kind of that got me and a lot of people involved. Though, of course, I had a TI 82, 83, which is sort of the, you know, little bit later. And I remember you could play Tetris on that, you know, Mario Brothers. I don't think I actually programmed it. I thought it was programming. It was more like copying things from friends, but it felt like programming.
Well, it's one of the best ways to learn. You look at somebody else's example and you decide to tweak it, modify it, and then you end up with something that's, you know, kind of yours and kind of what you drew from.
Yeah, no, exactly. And you need some sort of hands-on aha moment with why am I going to dive into the details? So it's interesting to see what it is for people, whether it's a calculator or games or the web or something else. There, you have to kind of have that first, right? Like, because otherwise, programming for the sake of programming doesn't make any sense unless you have a goal in mind.
You definitely have to have the why.
Yeah. So after high school, then, where did your passion take you?
Family moved again, left me in a small town in Pennsylvania with really no prospects. I missed the registration period for college, actually did not get into college at that point. And so I decided to join the Air Force. Joined the Air Force to see the world, spent 3 years in Biloxi, Mississippi, and 3 years in Washington, D.C.
That's one part. That's two parts of the world. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, especially since born and raised in Baltimore, it's not like, you know, Washington was all that unfamiliar to me. So.
Yeah. Well, I see that. I mean, skipping ahead because we have our notes. So I think the first time Python came in the scene for you was 99, I think, which is very early on in Python's history. How did it pop up on your radar?
So I was working on a project at the time. We were migrating some servers from Windows NT to Linux. We were using a very early distro. Don't even remember which one now. And we had a need for a process that would monitor a directory to see when files showed up. So there would be people who would FTP files to this box, and the process needed to detect the changes in the directory and then process the files. And I found a snippet out on the internet, wasn't all that big, 20, 25 lines of Python that would monitor the directory and then do something with it. And that something was what we needed to do with it, run another script as a result of it. And I first took a look at Python and it's like, okay, this is different than anything I've ever seen before. The syntax, significant white space, and it was certainly more verbose than the other languages of the time that I'd worked with other than COBOL. And it just really appealed to me, actually. I won't say I ever really had a fondness for COBOL, but I certainly had enough proficiency with it that verbose languages were not a problem per se. But something just with the requirement that the code be laid out in a structured way, unlike C, you know, with all the hidden gotchas with the braces, missing semicolons, whatnot, it really resonated that the layout of the language just helped make the structure of the program so much clearer than trying to pair up braces or parens or whatever.
Can I ask, at that time, what would you say about the kind of abstraction level that the language operates at? Because you said 25 lines of Python, it's kind of like the archetypal situation is, I need to script something up, I do it in Python. Oh, it's 25 lines. It's always 25 lines. It doesn't matter what you're doing. Compared to, say, the other language you mentioned, C, it's like it's going to take you loads more than 25 lines to do it in C. Like, so how was the abstraction level compared to what else you had available?
Mostly it was the strength of the libraries. So the language is what attracted me at first. And then I started looking at the standard lib. And looking at, you know, seeing the comments about being batteries included and just starting to read through the library documentation. And it's like, wow, you know, there's a lot here. It's not, okay, perhaps a bit pedantic of me. It's not so much that the abstractions were at a higher level, but that the libraries were so comprehensive that I didn't need to go hunting for a library to do X or to, you know, find a code snippet somewhere else that did X. Is that, okay, there's a function for that. And I just call this function and it's there.
Imagine that. Yeah. Well, and that was, I had to look it up. I think that was around Python was 1.5 or so. So it was
1.5.
Stable enough to, you know, have the ecosystem that makes it so powerful of libraries and all the rest.
Definitely.
Yeah. It's so interesting thinking about when people first see Python, what their reaction is, because, you know, many programmers like you come from much more less abstracted languages. But when I was teaching college students, who didn't know much programming at the time, I would just lay out, I'd say, here's Hello World in, you know, Java, C, Python. Just like, you don't know anything about programming, which one do you think is easier to use? Right? I mean, you just look at it and you know. Right.
Oh, yeah.
So it's sort of absolutely. An interesting, you know, whatever level of programming ability, you can just look at it and say, oh, you know, yeah, white space is very helpful. Oh, it's nice that something is shorter. And also that if I want to print something, it's called print. It's not 13 lines of gobbledygook. So
can I ask, at that stage, at the, you know, the 1.5 stage, were there third party libraries that you ran into quickly? And what were they? Because, you know, later on, it was Django and requests and, you know, these other big stalwarts of the ecosystem. But what about then?
At that stage, no, I really wasn't aware of the third-party ecosystem. My needs at that time, I mean, at that point in time, let's see, 99. Yeah, 99, I was still doing a lot of low-level work with server management. The company that I worked for at the time was an insurance firm, and they had 300 offices scattered around the United States. And so what we were doing is that we had this rather intricate dial-up system that we would distribute updates from the home office. We would dial to their local network, send files to them. And that was the purpose of this code, is that we would send data updates to them, whether they be rate changes or customer updates, whatever. We'd send these update files out to them, and then the system would receive the files, unzip them, and add them to the local copy of the database. Because at that time, there was no wide area network that we could afford to implement through these 300 offices. Broadband internet was still a dream in the future. Everything was dial-up. And so it was do the processing in the home office, distribute the files overnight. They come in the morning and they've got refreshed data.
Yeah, but over the wire updates, that's you know, they're still doing that with iPhones now. You know, I get a little message.
That's true.
Ulysses has been updated to the latest version. That's cool, though. That's really cool.
And that's so funny to me, too, because my brother-in-law uses Django at a health insurance company called Zipari that does exactly that, you know, with Django 20 years later. So it's sort of the tools have changed a little bit, but the problem is still there about, you know, collating all this health insurance data.
Yeah. You know, how do you keep 300 computers in sync that aren't directly connected to any sort of internet or direct networking? It's an interesting problem.
Right.
Yeah.
So Django, speaking of the web, when did that emerge for you?
So I first saw Django, it was PyCon 2005, I believe it was. In my mind, I've dubbed that the PyCon of web frameworks, because that was like the time period, the 2004-2005 time period, where the saying was, you know, you haven't worked in Python until you've at least written one web framework. And there were dozens of them floating around, some better than others, you know, and a number of them just kind of faded off rather quickly. But all of a sudden, out of the blue, there's this new one that poked its head up, said, "Hi, I'm here, Django." And I remember at the time, Guido making some comment, I don't know whether it was a keynote or just a talk or even possibly just an offhand remark, that he was expressed an opinion, personal opinion, that, you know, he felt that there was going to need to be some sort of shakedown of this plethora of web frameworks, you know, that there really doesn't need to be 10 different web frameworks all receiving a lot of attention. And he kind of thought, you know, had a very favorable impression of Django at that point. So it's like, okay, if Guido's leading in that direction, it's worth taking a look at it. So I did. Then promptly had a position change, job change, same company, position change, and completely left the Python world. I had nothing more to do with Python from a job perspective for about 10 years. So I kept my eye on it. You know, I always kept my fingers in the Python world as a hobbyist more than anything else. But over the next 5 years or so, I saw where Django as a complete web framework really kind of gained the mind share. But I never had a reason to work with it. Then I actually did change jobs in 2014. I had a company, another insurance company, hire me as a Python/Django developer. And while I acknowledged that I had no direct Django experience, apparently my Python knowledge was adequate for him to say, okay, you know Python, you can learn Django, and dropped me into the deep end of the pool.
I just want to point out that PyCon 2005 was, I think, only the third one. And it says on Wikipedia, there were only like 400 people there. So you were pretty early. I guess it was in DC. Was that you were based? So it was it was local, but.
It was. That's the point. I was living in Baltimore, working in Baltimore at the time. And, you know, said to my boss, hey, there's this Python conference that happens to be local. And he said, sure, no travel expenses, no hotel expenses.
Yeah, exactly.
Buy your lunch, maybe.
Because you know, now PyCon is, you know, 4,000 people, and but it's funny that you mentioned Guido, because I went to my first one 2019, after going to DjangoCon twice, and I was like, oh, it's gonna be like DjangoCon, but a little bit bigger, and it's, you know, orders of magnitude bigger. But at lunch the first day, I looked up from the buffet, and it was Guido right across from me. I was like, oh man, like, huh? I guess it sort of like made it real in a way. Anyways, just to get my anecdote in there, but I just want to point out, yeah, it wasn't like everyone was going to PyCon in 2005. It's also interesting because when we interview people, there's quite a lot of people who, when they move away from Python and Django professionally, their personal and community interest spikes almost as like an antidote to their day job. And, you know, eventually they find their way back to the fold professionally, but it can take a while. So that's not unusual.
Well, I've been involved in a number of different hobbyist communities through the years. And what really struck me was how wonderful the people were at that first PyCon. I mean, I met some people that they may not even remember meeting me. But the impression that they left on me, you know, the attitude towards people at that point, of course, again, you know, as you're saying, 400 people, it much more intimate setting. And I walked out of there, you know, knowing this was a group of people that I wanted to continue to associate with, which is something that I found lacking in a number of other professional conference environments. I'll put it that way.
Yeah, very, very diplomatic.
But it's rare to have conferences built around learning and sharing as opposed to sales, maybe especially in technology. If I think about, you know, that's something sort of take for granted going to PyCon and DjangoCon, but most tech conferences are a monstrosity of sales, effectively.
I don't doubt that, but that's, you know, I was thinking in terms of other hobbyist type organizations, other PC-based groups or microcomputer groups that I have been affiliated with in the past, more so than the professional type conferences, because those at least I know what I'm getting into.
Yeah.
You know, you go to Share, and are you either of you familiar with what Share is?
No.
Share is the international IBM users community, if you will. Dates back to the late 60s, back when IBM operating systems were effectively open source, because you'd buy your IBM mainframe, they'd send you the tapes with the source, and you had to actually build your operating system for your hardware configuration. And so Share as a user community grew out of that as what sits in my mind as really the first open source community, even though it was not known by that name at the time. And so Share was an opportunity for mainframers to get together and share patches and updates and things that they had done with the operating system to make it work better. And so, but Share grew in the 70s to being, as you described, these ultimate huge commercial endeavors as much as anything else. Yet they still at their core tried to be focused on the community, the fact that it's users helping users, rather than, you know, under the sponsorship of IBM, rather than being an IBM conference.
Yeah, I mean, I used to live in San Francisco where they had Dreamforce, the Salesforce version, which is sort of my main experience with something that would just overwhelm the city for a week at a time. And, you know, they'd have U2 play shows. And it's just like that show, Silicon Valley, where you'd have tech people on stage with musicians. Rings very true. But anyways, so DjangoCons, let's talk about those, because
yeah, DjangoCons, because that's where I met you, Ken. Like you,
and that's
you
where know, I met you too.
Came out to the US and massive long way, and then come to the stagger to the desk, get there. I'm like, I've arrived, and you're like, hello, and I met you. You're like the first face of DjangoCon that I saw. So how did you get involved, and what's your story there?
I like to think of myself as a very selfish person. I know what I want, and I'm willing to do what I think is necessary to help achieve that. I want good conferences. I want good PyCons. I want good DjangoCons, because I get more out of a good conference than a poor conference. I also know from having been on the other side of the desk, in the working at and administering and running conferences, what a pile of headaches that is. You know, I believe that every tech person should be required to run at least one conference if nothing else, to gain an appreciation of what that really takes. And I've done my fair share of work on that back end. I know the headaches that come with it. One of the most serious headaches is wrangling the cats, volunteers, to actually show up on time when they say they're going to be somewhere to get things done.
So you're like the sergeant
major.
One
of the absolutely, absolutely critical roles is that person at the front desk to make sure that the people coming in don't feel lost, know that they're in the right place, and are to some degree acknowledged. You know, hey, you're here. Welcome. We're glad you're here. That's something I can do. And I know by doing that, then the people in the back office who have more important things to worry about than greeting the people at the front can continue to take care of that. And I can do that. Quite frankly, it's really easy to do. It's not that it requires a significant amount of effort. It requires zero prep time. I just show up and I do my job.
You got to wake up early in the morning, though, right? Because, like, let's be honest, people, you know, the first day they're there at like 7:30 a.m. And by the last day of a multi-day conference, it's, you know, more like 10 a.m. when people roll in. But they're already registered, so less to do.
Yeah. And the workload tails down. That first morning rush is always entertaining. But I'm a naturally early riser anyway. I've worked for many, many years like a 6 to 2, 6 to 3 shift. So it's not unusual for me. And then when you think about conferences being on the West Coast, that does not help matters any, because, you know, I'm waking up at 2 a.m. in the morning, first couple of days. And again, you know, 3 a.m., 4 a.m. in the morning, what else are you going to do? Well, you get up, you have breakfast, got nothing better to do, go downstairs, start pulling out tables, setting stuff up, and you're ready to go.
Well, Carlton and I felt quite pleased with ourselves, with our strategy at the last DjangoCon, where, you know, because Carlton's coming from Europe, and I'm just from the East Coast. And, you know, so we got up and we did bike rides every morning. I think we were out the door by 6, Carlton, right?
It was quite early. Yeah. It was good, though. I mean,
it sounds too much like exercise.
It was quite a lot like exercise. Will obviously goes to the gym or something in his normal life, whereas I'm a bit like, ooh, what's that? I remember those from childhood. It's a bike, yes.
But both of us met you at the registration desk, and then I volunteered the ones after that, both at PyCon, DjangoCon, and you're right. It's so overwhelming the first conference you go to, because you don't know anyone, you don't know what's going to happen, and then to have a friendly faces sets the tone for the rest of the conference, for sure. I mean, I was, you know, in that bucket, my first DjangoCon and first PyCon as well. So, and it's a great way to meet people, as you said. I mean, you know, if you go to conferences to meet people instead of having to, you know, chit chat at a table, if you work at the conference desk, you're just bound to meet.
Oh, I'm horrible with small talk. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it sort of solves that problem.
It really does.
So maybe I can ask, since you've been to way more PyCons and DjangoCons than either of us, what's your sense of how the DjangoCons in particular and just the community has developed over the last, you know, 5 to 10 years in particular? What's your sort of broad sense of all that?
I mean, the DjangoCon community just continues to amaze and impress me because of the focus and the intentiveness on the user experience, the customer experience, the attendee experience, however you want to phrase that, you know, for really putting that focus, that emphasis on trying to make everybody feel welcome and accepted. And hey, you are one of us. It doesn't matter where you're from. It doesn't matter what you do in your job or not do, you know, student, hobbyist, whatever. You took the effort, made the initiative to come here. You're one of us now. And we're going to do everything we can to take care of you.
And that includes briefing, like, the other attendees, right? So when the conference starts, there's always that kind of half-hour presentation about, you know, what is a DjangoCon and why is it so welcoming and you know, they have this idea about standing in the Pac-Man rule where you always leave a gap for someone to come and join. And then, you know, this idea that how N is the number of Django cons you've been to. Well, you know, N plus one, you've got to meet that many people each day. So, you know, if it's your first one, you've only got to meet a couple of people. But if you've been to 15, then, well, you've got to get out there and, you know, really get to know folks. It's just little things like, you know, they're not little, they're massive, but they really structure the day for me, and they structure the conference and structure the mood.
I think that last point there really hits it for me, you know, striking that mood, setting that mood for the conference that, okay, yes, it is DjangoCon. It's not that it's not about Django, because it very definitely is about Django, but it's about the people working with Django. And that's a mood that's I think can't be overstated, because it's just so absolutely critical to the experience of the people attending.
And I do want to note, I mean, specifically for the U.S. Django cons, there's DEFNA, the Django Events Foundation of North America, which is a nonprofit that exists to support Django cons, because each one requires a lot of work by people on the ground. But to have an overriding organization that helps with everything makes it a lot easier. They also, they contribute to the Django Software Foundation every year, whatever proceeds they have from the conferences. So certainly for the US one, having that organization, the people on it, Jeff Triplett, Craig Bruce, Adam Fast, there's some others. That's in a way thankless work, but hopefully people, you know, you go to the conferences and you meet them, because they're the ones running around, not at the conference desk, not speaking, but doing everything else to make it a great experience.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, let's get to the forum. So this is, actually, before we get that, congratulations on winning this year's Malcolm Trudnick Award.
Thank you.
That's no small thing, and that's an annual award for contributions to the larger Django community. And I think in particular, a lot of the people who nominated you mentioned the Django forum. So this is something new, and you are, I think, far and away the biggest contributor. So maybe you could, let's talk about what the Django forum is, and I'd be curious to hear about not just your involvement, but what you've learned engaging with so many people this past year or so on the forum.
I must confess my initial reaction to your statement there. I may or may not be the biggest, but I'm probably the most frequent.
Well, you pick the metric you want, you know.
I am probably larger than the average member. But leaving that aside, trying to become serious here.
So on the forum, there's all sorts of questions. There's more advanced topics around where to put the logic, favorite third-party packages, but there's a lot of people new to the community who have questions on getting started and more fundamentals. And in particular in that area, you've been very active. So I'm curious how have those interactions been? Like, what is that? Because sort of like being the registration desk in a way, that people ask a question and, you know, they don't go to Stack Overflow, they go to the forum, which is really has experts. And, you know, but so what sort of patterns do you see, right? Because a lot of times it's kind of the same question over and over that beginners have around getting started in Django.
It is or it isn't, although I do tend to kind of paint a broad brush for some of the real recent people who are diving into it. I know that I emphasize a lot what I consider the two most frequently used or referenced tutorials, being the official Django tutorial and the Django Girls tutorial, which I think both are very excellent. Yeah. They both cover a broad span of subjects from slightly different perspectives. And I recommend both highly because they'll give you two different angles on something. I know for myself, when I'm learning something new, I can't just look at it from one angle and expect to understand it. I typically need to look at something from two, three, or even four different angles before I start to build a mental model that resonates. And I still remember from 7 years ago now what my sticking points were with Django and the difficulties that I had in learning it and moving from the other frameworks that I had worked with. And I know I have detected that for the people coming in who are new to Django, you know, you can divide them into two very broad categories. There are the people that are new to web frameworks in general and they're just learning Python and they're just learning Django, and it's, hey, I want to produce a web page. And they have one mindset or one perspective that they're coming from. On the other hand, you have people that may have experience in other web frameworks, whether it be Spring or .NET or one of the PHP frameworks, Drupal, WordPress, whatever, that are moving to Django, moving to Python. And they come at it from a very different perspective. Because the first group is, I don't know how to do X. How can I get to point X? And those are the ones that I try to steer to the tutorials initially, because, you know, they need that foundation, something to build on. You know, here, build these basic building blocks. Then if you still have problems, we at least have a terminology, a common terminology that we can work forward from. But let's get some basics out of the way. Let's make sure that we're using the same words for the same things. Then on the other hand, you've got the people that are coming from a different framework. So they already have some idea of, I want to do X, and this is how I would do X in framework
A. Exactly.
Now, how do I translate that to Django?
Yeah. Where's the controller?
And that can be a much more challenging issue, because they actually have to unlearn the familiar patterns of how they would do things in that other framework and recognize the fact that Django has its own patterns, its own ways of doing things that aren't a direct translation from a different framework. And the phrase that I use most often on that is, don't fight the framework. Don't try to make Django work like WordPress. Don't try to make Django work like Spring. You're going to create yourself headaches. Don't change the framework, change your mindset.
But that applies at every level. I mean, quite often I do client work, and I'll go into a project where they've got me in because they got a project that's struggling. They've got to the point where they kind of can't progress further because of, you know, technical debt reasons, essentially. And more than 9 times out of 10, the issue is they're fighting the framework. They're trying to push it into the wrong way. And so you spend a lot of time moving things around so it starts to look like a Django app again. And then all of a sudden they can breathe, and it's like, ah, we can make movement now. So it's whether you're a beginner or not, go with the grain of what it's trying to do for you.
And achieving that mindset actually is one of the best benefits of attending a conference such as DjangoCon or, you know, whatever, again, whatever framework, it doesn't matter. The documentation can only take you so far. The documentation can tell you how to do X, but most documentation for pretty much any framework I can think of does a pretty poor job of saying, this is how you should think about X. You know, this is how you need to approach the problem so that the solution you're trying to implement makes sense.
Yeah, it's how versus why. I think it's harder, especially for official docs, which are typically written by a community, to maybe agree on that is one piece. But it's also the case that I've thought a lot about the fact that there's a difference between docs and tutorials. And people confuse that and want both, and I understand that, but they're separate for a reason. And a lot of the times when they're complaining about the docs, what they want is a tutorial that provides that sort of top level perspective, as well as the details which the docs can provide, because the docs can't be a tutorial. It's already a massive, well documented thing to be what it is. So the forum in particular, like some of the questions I've engaged in are, I think, a little more in that top down perspective, where around one of the ones I think that a lot of people responded to was where to put the logic in Django. Because as you progress in your Django journey, that's a very confusing thing. And I think maybe especially if you're coming from another framework, because the reality is you can do it a bunch of different ways. And there are some best practices, but it sort of does depend on how not to fight it. So I guess I'll tee that up to both of you. If someone says where to put the logic in Django, my quick take is, I would say if you can put it in the view, that's great. The model is probably better. I wouldn't dive into model managers unless you really have to, and I would keep it out of the templates. That's my really quick take. But there's a lot of ways to do it. I know, not an easy question. There's a lot of response. We'll link in the show notes to the, there's a lot of responses in the community to this question because there isn't a simple answer.
There's not, and it is so context sensitive. You know, there are cases where model managers are the right answer. There are cases where model managers aren't the right answer. You know, for any of those locations that you identified, there are specific situations where they are or are not the right answer. And so I don't think you can make a blanket statement that your logic always needs to go here.
And yet people want to know where to start though, right? I mean, that's the thing is like, that is the correct response, but they still say, okay, but how? And part of it I've seen too, is sometimes people, depending on what their background is, not understanding what Django can do and what Django can't do. So a lot of times they want to like pull in data from somewhere else, an API or a database, and they don't really know where to do the logic on that. So a lot of times it's, well, Django's not going to clean your data for you. Or I even had a long back and forth with someone who was like, what does Django even do for me? I was like, it does the web part for you. But, you know, because this person wanted, you know, I love the projects that beginners have because they're just, they're so, you know, for those of us with experience, it's just like, that sounds awful. And like, that's going to be impossible. But they're like, well, I want to pull in this and this and this and make it real time. And, you know, they're sort of unencumbered by reality, which is good because it makes us think about, you know, what could happen. But so much of it is outside of Django scope, wanting to apply logic to things, which is like, yeah, write a Python script. You know, Django can't help you with that. Anyways, some of the emails I get with Carlton, what's your response? You've been quiet.
Yeah. Okay. So, you know, Ken's right. It depends. But one analogy I always go back to is this idea of application layers. Right, where you've got, say, the model layer in the middle, and then, you know, a validation layer around that, and then you've got a view layer perhaps, and then some UI bits around that perhaps. You know, this is an old software architecture way of thinking about it, and I think that works quite well with Django in that you've got the model layer for, you know, business logic. And so one thing I do use managers for is to create a custom, say, create method where I need to pass in a couple of parameters and there's a bit of special hunky-dory logic there. I want that inside a manager, not, or inside something. I want it encapsulated so that the rest of my code doesn't have to see that nasty. And so I quite often use managers or custom query set methods for that kind of logic because the view then can pass into the model manager just what it needs, and then the model manager does that business logic. And then what does the view is left with? Well, the view's job is to take an HTTP request and turn it into an HTTP response. So is this logic related to view handling, HTTP? If it is, it belongs in the view. Sometimes you get some data from the view and you want to pass it to the model layer, but that's you can't just pass it straight in. You don't want the model layer throwing out DB errors because you passed it bad data. So that's where we'll have a form. And sometimes form logic can be quite complicated. And particularly a model form, when you hit save, it gives you back an instance. So any kind of logic about validating the data and getting it ready to pass to the model layer, that lives in the form. And then, I don't know, you might have an HTML button that it has different values depending on, I don't know, what's going on your site. And so you might create a template tag for, you know, site app button, and then you might pass it a parameter, and it does all the fancy logic to generate the HTML that you don't really want to put in get context data.
Right.
I mean, you could call it from get context data, but, you know, then you'd need a little helper function to keep it tidy. Well, it could just live in a custom template tag, which are really easy to write, folks, you know. The DTL is actually super powerful. So again, it depends. But that's how I kind of think about it. I try and think of what layer does this. And what I don't want is the model layer having to reach out and do something for the view layer. I don't mind the view layer reaching down to the model layer and saying, hey, please, can you provide this service for me? But what I don't want is it the other way around. And try and keep some sort of cleanliness like that. But beyond that, it's impossible to say without a concrete example.
Well, that what you just said, Carlton, you've referred me to, we'll put in the notes, Tom Christie has a post from 2014 sort of to your point on Django models, encapsulation and data integrity.
I will link to that, to the heat death of the universe. That is such a great post. It is, it's just amazing. And more or less that, I don't quite agree with him about model forms at the very end, but the rest of it is dead right. And there was a debate recently. Somebody wrote a book about, I can't remember the exact title, but it was about creating a service layer, and they were very anti Django and the ORM in it. And there was a couple of posts, one by James Bennett and another one by Luke, whose surname escapes me momentarily. Replying about, you know, how you create a service layer in Django, or how you avoid creating a service layer using the ORM the way it wants to be used. Like, and again, this goes back to cutting with the grain of the framework.
Well, and in the forum discussion, Andrew Godwin and some others talk about that services argument, because I think it was timely when that was brought up. Yeah. But I think part of the thing is, you know, we, like, if I was going to teach someone this, you almost want to show them, well, here's the five ways you could do that same, you know, save method, so that they have the context to understand why one is better than the other. Because a lot of times they don't know how to do any of the five. So to talk about, well, this goes here, that goes there, they sort of need the reps to understand how the pieces fit together, I think, right? Like, I've thought about, like, how many different ways can I do a to-do app, or even Hello World. Actually, I have a post on Hello World done five different ways, which I think is quite clever, but I think I haven't explained it well enough to get kind of get at this, you know, multiple takes on the same issue to show how the pieces fit together, because it does take quite a while to understand how the pieces fit together in Django.
Does your do your ways include Carlton's single file way of doing a Hello World that he showed at Django Con a couple
years ago? I'll link to that too. I made a whole GitHub repo for that, and there's been discussions. I don't know if I do. I'll put the links in. Because I think it's, the thing is that by the time you get to showing how to do one thing five different ways, you've lost most people. So, you know, like this Hello World one, I don't mention it to beginners, because I know it's just going to confuse them. When I'm like, you don't actually need to have a views.py file. Like, you can stick the view in there, and, you know, and then Carlton's thing is just, you know, that's mad scientist realm. But I'll put the link in there. I should link to
that's,
it.
That's just to show how it all fits together, right? I have created and do create single folder Django apps, right? But a single file Django app, nah.
Yeah. Okay. So I see, I'll add it actually after this. So I have it. It's Django Hello World, five different ways. And I'll put a link to Carlton's talk. Yeah. Cause I have a whole repo with the code, because Carlton put the code up on his slides, but yeah. How quickly can you lose someone asking a question about Django?
I think the point you made just there, Will, was about reps. Like, and that's why I like books, like, you know, guides around. I think we can't have it all in the Django docs, as you said, but like books like yours, where you can go pick it up and you can go through it, and there's several different projects and there's different things, and they teach you the different aspects. I think that's an essential resource on the side. You can't just have it all in the Django docs, because they'd become unmanageable. They're already, you know, massive.
I mean, I almost think that another future book would literally be a book on the simplest CRUD site done 5-10 different ways to, as a intermediate level thing, just to illustrate all these kind of points, like just to show, like, well, because I usually in the beginner's book, I talk about different ways to do it, but I show the way that I think is the most elegant, accurate way for a beginner to do it. I don't overwhelm them, but maybe for a next book, it'd be like, well, here are all these different ways you could do it. That might actually be an interesting thing, though. I feel like it's hard to know what people will want, but they should go through something like that if someone felt inclined to make it. But speaking of Django, we're coming up on time, Ken, but one of the questions we wanted to ask you was ways to improve Django in the broadest sense. You know, if you had a magic wand, what are things, you know, technical, community, otherwise, what do you think are some ways that Django can improve itself going forward so it stays relevant?
I consider myself kind of an outlier in terms of usage in the Django community. I've known from talking to many people, how I use Django is really different from most people that I talk to. I'm not sure that I actually have a good opinion on that question, because for what I do with Django professionally and hobbyist, out of the mainstream in terms of, you know, you think about Django, it builds websites. And so what is a website? A website is designed to present information to people. Okay, I do that, but the appearance of the website, how it looks, how a person interacts with that, is much less important in my job than the actual data that I am retrieving and displaying to the user. My websites will never receive any awards other than possibly a Razzie for their appearance, for their look and feel. Because I'm writing websites for internal company employees in very small numbers. My average website has two users.
Yeah, right.
That's my average user base per website. And look and feel just really isn't an issue there. I just need Django to be able to go out, collect data from different sources, and present that in some way that an engineer can look at. For example, my current project that I'm working on, I'm decoding TCP dump PCAP files, and I am decoding them and presenting packet level displays so that it's, in a sense, it's Wireshark through a browser.
Yeah, I was just about to say that. It's Wireshark in the browser, but you got there first.
Yeah, but it's even more targeted than that, because I am picking out particular fields. It's not presenting the full frames. It's highlighting specific data fields and organizing that so that an engineer looking at the network traffic sees at a glance what it is that they're interested in seeing.
I think this kind of thing is more common than you give it.
I think most people are doing... I think most Django engineers aren't touching the front end at all.
But like low traffic, like it's an internal application. It's not, you know, you're not trying to serve 100 people concurrently. You're trying to serve 100 people all month, that sort of thing. And that's very frequent. And, you know, these kind of internal data analysis type presentation, I think that's a lot. You know, obviously the agencies, you go to the conferences, it's like, oh, we work on this big site and that's user facing. But I think a lot of people are using Django in this way.
May very well be.
What would make your use case easier?
Honestly, I don't have an answer to that.
Okay.
Part of it is I've gotten so used to Django as it is. I've become very comfortable with what I'm doing, with how I'm doing things. I think the biggest improvements that I've seen over the past couple of years has actually been in the tooling around Django itself. You know, had you asked me this question 3-4 years ago, it was like, find me something that lets me get rid of Eclipse, please. And with Visual Studio Code now, Eclipse is ancient history. So it's all the tooling that is, you know, maybe I'm just becoming more aware of it, but things like Black or Pep8,
Or iSort.
You know, other facilities of tools around Django itself that is making it a more complete environment, that I'm seeing the things now that I was used to working in a Java Spring environment or .NET. You know, I'm seeing this type of first-class support around Django. So it's not that I have any recommendations for Django itself. It's that I'm giving huge kudos to the people who are working around the fringes, you know, who are doing things that are adding on these external features, though, that make working with Django that much easier and that more seamless in terms of keeping things moving forward.
Yeah, super. Super. And so to follow up then, what would you say the last 12 months is your favorite package that you found that fits in that club?
Ooh, putting me on the hot
seat.
Yeah,
come on.
Oh.
Well, we were just on Talk Python, and Michael Kennedy always asks his guests that at the end. So I think so that's it's top of mind.
Be our new one.
I'd have to say what has changed my life most significantly in the last 14 to 15 months has been a much more aggressive use of Visual Studio Code and getting it integrated into my workflow.
Okay.
You know, I started out using it as a Eclipse replacement, you know, basic editing and putting projects together. But as I continue to work with it and learn how it works and understand how to do things with it, the different configuration files like custom launch.json files and using the debugger with it, I've just more integrated. I've gotten more in depth, more comfortable with it, more as a tool than just an editor.
Yeah. No. Okay. That's a good answer.
And so that's been my biggest improvement in my workflow over the last year.
Okay. Super.
Yeah. Well, I think all three of us, that's our primary editor these days. I know, Carlton, you BB Edit, right? You have one that you get to occasionally.
So I've been using BB Edit forever. I have it open all the time because as great as VS Code is and its multi-file search is very fast, when you're trying to pick through, say I'm trying to pick through a trace in Django and I'm trying to have all the source files open and all the rest, BB Edit's multi-file search is just phenomenal, and you can have the different searches open in different results windows, and you know VS Code doesn't like you doing that because it's got to fire up a JavaScript. It's basically got to fire up a new instance of Chrome for every window you open with. Like, that's fine, but you can only open so many. Whereas BB Edit's a native Mac app, and it's for that kind of forensic research through a big code base, it's indispensable for me.
I still use Atom too. I mean, sometimes I just want a different editor. I want something. My Atom config is very, very, very basic. And it's sort of like, in a way, my BB Edit, because my VS Code is all customized. And sometimes I just don't want to deal with any of that. I just want something simple. So.
Oh, yeah. I still use Notepad++ for some things. Nano on occasion. You know, if I just need to hop onto a server and make a quick patch or something. Yeah. You got to be comfortable with lots of tooling.
Are you on Windows, Ken? Can I just ask?
My primary development laptop here is Windows, but I do a lot of my development in WSL.
Yeah, I was going to ask. So are you using the WSL?
So I'm stuck at WSL 1 for the moment because WSL 2 does not support IPv6. And that is absolutely required for the stuff that I do. It's Windows, WSL 1. I do run VirtualBox for some local virtual machines. And then my server room, all of my servers are various shades of Linux.
Okay, cool. I like how you've got a server room. I need a server room. That sounds like a nice thing to have.
Well, as we head out, are there any tips you have for people listening who can start to be as involved in the Django community as you have been? What would you say are good first steps for someone who's using Django but wants to get more involved?
Online, I'd say I'm partial to the forum more so than the mailing lists. I think I find the forum to be more personable, than the mailing list. Django users is a fine mailing list. I still read it, but I was never really active on it, because it just, for whatever reason, that interface feels impersonal to me.
No, the forum's much nicer.
And so I very much appreciate the forum because it feels more community-like than the mailing list ever did to me. And it's like, please join the forum, browse some messages, and if you've got something to say to chip in, answer a question, people don't bite. You know, I remember my first couple of answers, there was a lot of trepidation. It's like, well, if I answer this, who's going to jump on me and say, you're wrong.
And that's pretty rare.
It didn't happen. You know, I've been corrected enough times, but you know, that's all part of the learning process.
Right.
There are a couple people that I won't name, but they've been very kind in pointing out when I've made mistakes. You know, and for that, I am grateful.
Well, I think one of the nice things about the UI of the forum is that when you use the search functionality, if you type in a question, it will pull up if it's already been asked and answered. Because I would say beyond not looking very nice. My biggest issue with Google Groups is it's very hard to surface past conversations. So there's 10, 20, 30 takes on the same thing. And the forum is nice to have it in one more of one place. And it's easier to read through. And, you know, I think so similar to Stack Overflow, there's sort of one place for certain questions around different topics. So I think that's helpful. So what about offline? when we're all able to meet in person, what would you recommend? I mean, obviously attend a DjangoCon, and sounds like, you know, put your hand up to volunteer.
Or even the local Django meetup.
That's true.
Had met a person, individual, at a DjangoCon 3-4 years ago, and we created a local Baltimore group to try and do some meetups. Unfortunately, that kind of faded away for a couple different reasons. Lack of a place to meet being a big one. But, you know, it doesn't take much to actually try to form a local group. If you can't find something local, it doesn't hurt to say, put out some flyers metaphorically. You know, go online, meetup, what's it, meetup.com, that you can create local meetups, or even show and tell in the forums, probably a place that you could say, hey, I'm looking to meet people in area XYZ, and try to find a local community. And if there's not one close by, even see if there's one that you can get started. Certainly there's a lot to be said for meeting in person.
You only need two of you, you know?
Well, that's what
had two of you in an open invite.
Rachel Calhoun on recently, who works with Django Girls, and she was in Korea at the time, and it was two or three people who wanted to study Python. And that's, yeah, how they got started. You just need a handful of people. And often it's a Python thing, because Django is obviously a subset. So, you know, it's fine if it's a Python meetup. In Boston, where I am, there's, you know, a lot of developers. So there's Python and Django, but usually the Python one, you can start talking about Django there too. So anyways, I think we're at about an hour. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us.
Yeah, super.
Congratulations again on the Malcolm Award.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you very much.
Are there any outgoing thoughts you want to share with anyone?
No, just thank you both very much for hosting me this morning. This has been a pleasure. Will, Carlton, it's always a joy to be able to talk with either one of you. Looking forward to the day when we can all meet in person again.
Yes. Perhaps 2022 now, but hopefully, fingers crossed.
Yeah, virtual and then until. Thank you, Ken. For everyone listening,
yes,
you can find us at ChatDjango on Twitter and DjangoChat.com for this and future episodes. We'll see you all next time.
Join us next time. Bye-bye.